Hello and welcome to episode 12 of the Policy Agendas podcast presented by the Policy Agendas Project. I am EJ Fagan. Today I am joined by Brooke Shannon.
Hello.
And Christine Bird.
How you doing?
And we are here to talk to Frank Baumgartner. Frank is the Richard J. Richardson Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Carolina, Chapel Hill. He was the one of the co-founders of the Policy Agendas Project, and he's the author of the book we're going to discuss today, Suspect Citizens, What 20 Million Traffic Stops Tell Us About Policing and Race, along with his co-authors, Derek Epp, who has been on this podcast before, and Kelsey Shube. Frank, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, so we have some questions about this book. This book came out in 2017, but it's a part of an ongoing project. So I'm going to have Brooke take that away.
Sure. So again, the book is called Suspect Citizens, and it's a really fascinating fascinating story about street-level bureaucrat interaction with folks. And so we want to know what the book's origin story was.
The origin of this book is a little bit complicated. It goes back to a previous book I wrote about the death penalty. And that book came out in 2008, and then I moved to North Carolina to the UNC in 2009, and I immediately became acquainted with and got to be kind of integrated into a world of people who work on capital punishment from the defense side. And this is a group of people who are just really interesting and also very connected in with civil rights attorneys and people working on social justice and racial disparity issues throughout the criminal justice system. And a couple of years after I moved, one of them asked me if I would volunteer because I found that they've discovered that I'm their favorite free statistical consultant. Would I volunteer to serve on a task force to look into racial disparities in the North Carolina criminal justice system? And other people were looking at prison populations, drug arrests, school-to-prison pipeline. And they handed me a CD and said, would you look at these data? These are all the traffic stops in North Carolina. And so that was how it started. It was, I think that might have been 2011. So 7 years later, we were able to write a book about it. But it took a long time to figure out how to work with this massive data set. And then also, I didn't know anything about policing. And so I had to learn, we all had to learn a lot.
Yeah, so in the book, we learn a lot about these terms. I feel like some are very well acquainted with, like driving while black. So I'm hoping you can explain a little bit of like defining these terms, things like driving while black, and maybe touch on something like explicit versus implicit bias, which comes through really well in this book, but some folks might not know.
Well, the question of driving while black is something that white drivers might have concerns or questions about, but most black or Hispanic drivers don't have any questions about whether there's such a thing. And it's the idea that a minority driver would be subject to increased police surveillance compared to a white driver. And that was been in the news a lot, starting, I think, in the 1990s. And it really surged to a lot of attention in the late 1990s. Then it kind of faded away after the 9/11 attacks in 2001, and we didn't hear so much about driving while black anymore because now we had a whole different set of concerns about terrorism and policing changed a little bit. But in the meantime, North Carolina was the first state in the country to mandate collection of traffic stop data on all traffic stops, and that was an effort to either debunk the myth of so-called driving while black, or perhaps validate the concerns of minorities, drivers, and community leaders who said that there was such a thing. Mm-hmm. And there was a editorial in the Raleigh News and Observer when the bill was being debated in the General Assembly in 1999 that said, we support the bill, and we believe that it will show there is no such thing, but if it does, we understand that our police leaders will take immediate action to address it. And so, anyway, that's where that term comes from, I think. And our data make it very, very clear that there is indeed such a thing. We showed one part of our analysis is necessarily less, it's not on as firm ground, that is comparing who's in the population to who gets pulled over. And we refer to this as the benchmark problem. We don't really know who's driving. We don't know who's speeding or violating the traffic laws. But we do know there are good data on, you know, who lives in which communities. And the best we can estimate is that, roughly speaking, an African-American driver has about twice the odds of being pulled over compared to a white driver, roughly speaking. And that's probably an underestimate of the true difference. But we know for sure that once you get pulled over, then we know exactly what happened to you. Did you get arrested? Did you get the car searched? Did you get a ticket? Did you get a warning? And there we can be very precise because we know both the numerator, that's everybody who got pulled over, and the denominator, what happened, what was the outcome of that traffic stop. So there we're on very firm ground. And there we show that controlling for other factors, the racial factor consists of about, it about doubles the rate of search after controlling for why did you get pulled over and all the other factors.
Yeah, so what you've just alluded to is the massive data contribution that this book brings to the political science canon. There's 20 million observations here. Can you talk a little bit about the process that your team used to cut up this massive data set to do analysis with this work, and what did your process look like?
Well, actually, the first part of the analysis was the most difficult. That was getting our hands around the data set itself. It came to us from the state in a relational database that actually was broken into, I think, five or six different databases. And so our first job was to use the UNC supercomputer cluster to merge all these different databases into one, what we call a rectangular database that we could open on a computer and analyze. So, for example, there was a database for the stop, and then there was a separate database that had information about searches, and there was a third database that only had information about contraband, if contraband was found. And then there was another database related to passengers, and there was another database related to the demographics of the driver. And all those had common ID numbers, so they could be merged together. But I could tell you it was a pain in the neck to try to work with the database at the beginning to just get it organized in a way that we could analyze it. Once we did, and I feel like this is an increasing problem in political science, we have these extremely interesting administrative data sets, but they're really hard to work with. And so I'm working with another one right now, which is everybody in North Carolina who's been arrested for anything ranging from taking a fish out of a river without a license or hunting and fishing violations to traffic violations all the way up to homicide. And it's everyone arrested for any offense at all. And it's about 8 million records. And it's simultaneously a gold mine for research and also a nightmare because it's a poorly organized database. And so we have to do a lot of just learning about how the database is organized and reorganize it. And for example, it has multiple rows in the database for each arrest. So the same person on a given day might be arrested for five different violations. And each of those is a row in the database. And then they might be indicted for a certain number of crimes on another date, and then maybe a year later, those violations will be resolved. They'll either plead guilty or they'll be found not guilty before a judge or whatever the resolution is. But those really relate to three different units of analysis. And so there's a lot of work in just understanding database management skills and also dealing with large amounts of data that require a lot of computer resources, and then a lot of skills that we don't teach in research methods classes because they're the preliminary work you have to do to get the database in a form that you can analyze. So we had to do a lot of that with this traffic stops project, and I feel like learning those skills is just an important part of the job now. It's an important thing that I try to make sure my students learn, even my undergraduates.
At some point, do you have to stop relying on statistical methods, right? I mean, are we throwing out hypothesis, and not even hypothesis tests, regression analyses, that type of framework that so much of political science is in? At 20 million traffic stops, that most of that becomes not useless, but difficult to use, right?
No, it's perfectly easy to use, and the really fun thing about it is everything is statistically significant.
That's the point, right? Every bump in the data creates a p-value of zero.
Definitely. Everything is significant. So then it gets you away from this discussion about is it significant to do I care about this? And that's a much better conversation because we have coefficients in our model which are, you know, like we show that, let's say if you're a black male driver, your odds of being searched after a traffic stop are, you know, 156, you know, 1.56 times greater, or whatever number is, a very large number, very great disparity, and we can have a discussion about it. Is that disparity large enough to be concerned about? But we don't have to worry about is it statistically significant, because everything is statistically significant.
Yeah, so speaking of that, who gets pulled over? What are these sort of like compounding identities or characteristics that you see in these data?
Well, some of the what I'm going to say will strike certain listeners as obvious, and other listeners might be surprised by them, and it kind of depends on the identity of the listener. So who gets pulled over is young black men. And also people in certain communities rather than other areas or other communities. And it also depends on what time of day it is. And I'm also particularly interested in not just who gets pulled over, but once you get pulled over, do you get searched? Mm-hmm. One of the bigger predictors is what time of day it is. If it's 2 a.m. and the police pull you over, there's a strong chance they're going to search your car. But if it's 8 or 7:30 a.m. and it's the morning rush hour, and for whatever reason you get pulled over, the police are concerned about keeping that traffic moving, and so they're unlikely to search the car. So some of the things are obvious when you think about it. Like, for example, if they pull you over for suspicion of drunk driving, they're going to search the car with a very high probability. On the other hand, there aren't that many such traffic stops. There's way more traffic stops for speeding. And a speeding traffic stop is very unlikely to lead to a search of the vehicle because most likely it was not a pretext. It was probably that you really were speeding and a radar gun said you were going 85 in a 60 zone, so you were going to get a ticket. But the officer doesn't necessarily suspect you of criminal behavior. On the other hand, if you're pulled over for expired registration tags, the officer might not really be that concerned about the expired tags. He might want to use that as a pretext to have a conversation because he sees you as, for whatever reason, a suspect. Mm-hmm. And so that was really what we tried to get to the bottom of in this analysis.
You seem to make a distinction where you can see in the data the difference between a fruitful and a fruitless search. Can you talk a little bit about what you see there?
Well, we were quite surprised in the analysis in general that the math is really bad for using traffic stops as a mechanism to find drug offenders. For example, we have about 20 million traffic stops in our database. Then of those, about 3% lead to a search of the vehicle. So that's about, I think, 600,000 vehicle searches. Of those, about 30% lead to the discovery of contraband. So that's about 200,000. Of those, only half lead to arrest, because the so-called contraband was in such small quantities, or it wasn't actually drugs, it was what might be called drug paraphernalia. Or if it was drugs, it was, you know, a prescription pill, which may or may not have been, the person may or may not have had with legal, might have been legal or not legal. So anyway, we just go through the numbers and show that using the vehicle code and the traffic, the vehicle code and the traffic code to search for drug offenders is really a needle in a haystack strategy that doesn't really add up mathematically to an efficient policing strategy. And the other thing you mentioned about fruitless searches, and the other thing we're trying to do in this research program is to bring people's attention to the fact that if the police do have the authority to pull you over when you're driving a car, because if you're driving a car, most likely, almost certainly, you're breaking some law in some way, shape, or form, even if it's you know, that either you're speeding, or if you're not speeding, then the officer could say you're impeding traffic by not going at the speed limit. So either way, you're breaking a law. And then there's many other laws, such as having a cracked taillight or an expired tag, which are technically violations of the law, but which may not be very serious violations. But still, once you break any law, you open yourself up to a police investigation. Now, if that investigation reveals that you were involved in crime, then you simply got caught, and you might be upset at getting caught, at having been caught, but you're a criminal. If the investigation yields no evidence of criminal activity, and the police officer then lets you go with a warning or with no action at all, and there was no contraband found as a result of the search, then you understand that you were fruitlessly searched, and perhaps you were humiliated and detained for potentially an hour. It could have been in a public place, maybe where friends might have seen you being searched by the police. It could have been in front of your school if you're a young person. So it can have some really bad consequences. And from the legal perspective, the police have no responsibility to avoid such things. Of course, they wouldn't want to engage in too many of them. But on the other hand, there's no penalty. And so we wanted to bring attention to the idea that each such fruitless search chips away a little bit at our fabric, at the democratic fabric, because it alienates a young person, typically a young man of color, from agents of the state and from the government. So we know from other research that I've not been involved in that involvement with the police and the courts and such things reduces the likelihood of voting, and it has all kinds of deleterious effects on people's political participation. And so our research, I think, pushes in that same direction to demonstrate some of the costs. But the costs have been secret, I should point out, to middle-class Americans who aren't concerned about it, because it doesn't happen to middle-class Americans, but it happens routinely to individuals who fit certain profiles.
I like what you say about it detracting from the democratic fabric of our society. It affects all sorts of things that you point out in this book. It could affect your participation, your voting, your whether or not you would want to become a police officer, whether or not you're going to engage with any other type of government bureaucrat, how you deal with the court system generally. Not all interactions with the court are of a criminal nature. It can be whether or not you show up for jury duty. Things like that are all compounded by the work that is in this book.
Do you is there any evidence that a fruitless search or a pattern of fruitless searches could make someone more likely to become a criminal?
Well, I think one of the big, in our book, we don't have evidence about individuals repeatedly being pulled over because we don't know the name or there's no identification of the individual. So I can only really speculate. But one of the issues about over-policing certain neighborhoods is that if people come to be alienated from the police and then don't trust the police, then we can see that they might be less likely to call the police when there's a need for law and order. In our analysis, we were able to take advantage of a reform in one city in North Carolina where the police chief mandated certain changes to police policies to de-emphasize the kinds of traffic stops that we think of as more pretextual, and to emphasize really community safety by pulling over people for speeding, running through stop signs and things like that, and reducing the number of traffic stops for relatively minor infractions or equipment failures or regulatory problems. And in that community, which is Fayetteville, North Carolina, there was an increase in calls to 911 after these reforms were implemented. So I think that was a sign that there was increased trust in the police and an understanding that the police were there for everybody. And people who live in high-crime areas need to trust the police more than anybody. And yet, they don't. on average, there's likely to be more alienation from the police precisely in those areas where you would hope, from a crime-fighting perspective, that people would be most cooperative with the police. But that's something that we haven't seen in America for a long time.
Something Derek told me that was an early criticism of this work is that people would say, this isn't about politics, this isn't about political science, this is criminology. And I thought that was really interesting because I was like, I can't think of a more fundamental question of politics than how much interference can the government have in somebody's life. Being searched is a fundamental question of politics and of your interaction with the government and of the social contract and all of those things. How do you respond when these criticisms pop up?
Well, I've written a book about the death penalty, a couple books about the death penalty as well, and you know, there's nothing more the government can do than, you know, take your life or plan to take your life in a judicial execution. And similarly, in traffic stops analysis, the behavior of the police towards its own towards citizens, I think, is inherently a question of government and should inherently be a question of political science. Unfortunately, I think it's true that within our discipline, there's been a reluctance to understand the politics and the importance of understanding these judicial outcomes. I mean, we've had papers desk rejected from major political science review journals for the absence of what they called political variables, such as partisanship of the governor or something of that nature. And as a political scientist, I found that to be quite insulting and misguided. So it was really frustrating.
So with 20 million observations, there's obviously quite a lot that you could do to dig deeper and go to different projects as well. And I know that this book is part of a pretty large research project. So we're wondering about different articles that have come after the book. We know that you've recently written on characteristics of the officers themselves. Can you tell us a little bit more about the ancillary projects to this book?
Yeah, after we got our hands around the North Carolina data, we realized that there were other states that had similar, very large data sets. In Illinois, I think there's over 30 million traffic stops that have been collected in Illinois, and California has just come online with some new traffic stops data. So it's really a growth industry, I think, for political science and criminology and other scholars. And every time we look at a new database, it turns out there's a couple new variables that aren't available in some of the old ones, such as how old is the car, does the car have out-of-state plates, etc. So we've been looking at various things. One major question we had was, would any of those additional control variables explain away the race effect? So we always look at that. And actually, we did a paper where we calculated the simplest ratio of the black search rate divided by the white search rate with no statistical controls at all. And then we calculated the most sophisticated and complete logistic regression that we could possibly do given the data that were collected in that state. And this analysis ended up covering, I think, Maryland, Illinois, North Carolina, several other states. It had almost 60 million observations altogether. Mm-hmm. And we found that the correlation between the simple ratio of the two search rates and the more sophisticated and statistically complete odds ratio between the for the logistic regression for the race effect correlated at 0.97. So what that meant was that if an analyst can calculate even the simple percent of black drivers and the percent of white drivers who get searched, that's a robust indicator. Right. It doesn't get explained away by other factors such as time of day, how old is your car, your age. So anyway, one thing was to check on the robustness of our findings, whether North Carolina was different than other states. We found that the findings are unfortunately depressingly common all across the United States. That was one. And then we've done a number of other projects. One, as you mentioned, we have a database for one city that where we know the characteristics of the officer. And it turns out that just like the driver, race and gender matter a lot, the race and gender of the officer make a big difference. And white male officers have much higher search rates, controlling for other factors. So that was a characteristic that we weren't able to study in the broader North Carolina study. And we've looked at a number of other elements, such as municipal reliance on fines and fees. And it turns out that the greater share of the municipal budget comes from fines and fees, the more likely that city's police department is to have a more aggressive traffic stop program, and also higher racial disparities in those traffic stops.
As far as the different states go, have you noticed any diffusion of these policies, or are other states looking to North Carolina to see the success, or maybe something that they don't want to publicize?
One of the first things that happened after our first report, I think in 2012, came out in North Carolina that showed these disparities was legislation was introduced to stop collecting the data. And so I think the data are, they're a challenge. But that was not successful, and North Carolina continues to collect the data. And I think other states have come online with similar data collection projects. The state of California recently passed a very extensive legislation requiring it, and those data will be rolling out over the next several years. And so I think there is a movement in general towards open data and greater access to computerized administrative records. And I think that for the next generation of political science and public policy scholars, that's going to be a gold mine. So those do come with some limitations. There can be a lot of typographical errors. There can be you really have to understand the nature of the administrative database you're working with. But I do believe that they're going to be increasingly common as government agencies of all kinds maintain pretty sophisticated databases about their activities. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sure you've also received criticism of like, well, isn't this just North Carolina? And isn't North Carolina different than other states? But it seems to me that maybe North Carolina is a great test case to start this type of analysis because it's not too urban, it's not too rural, it's not too southern, it's not too eastern. It's not, it's kind of a pretty good place to start in terms of what we look for in terms of it.
Yeah, that would be the Goldilocks theory of North Carolina. And I don't really subscribe to the Goldilocks theory of anything. I think every place is distinct, but there is nothing peculiar about North Carolina with regards to racial disparities in policing, because racial disparities in policing are apparent throughout the United States. For example, one of the reasons we got into this, or political scientists have been talking about this, was the U.S. Department of Justice investigation of Ferguson, Missouri. And in Ferguson, the Justice Department found that there was a 70% increased likelihood that a black driver would have their car searched compared to a white driver in Ferguson, Missouri. And this was part of the evidence about the extreme racial bias in policing in that community. Well, 70% is less than the statewide average disparity in North Carolina. So if we thought that it was an outrage that Ferguson, Missouri had such a big disparity, actually the disparity in North Carolina, I think, is over double. So, and as we expanded our studies into more and more communities, we did find a few outlying communities. And the one metropolitan region that we found that had the highest disparities, and of course this is an incomplete test because many communities don't have any data, but of all the ones that we've been able to look at, it was Chicago, Illinois, that had the highest racial disparities, some of the suburbs around Chicago and the city itself. And so I think that has to do with something about racial segregation and housing patterns, so that police can have a certain kind of behavior on the south side or the west side of Chicago, and a different type of behavior that's much less aggressive in the center part of the city or the northern part of Chicago.
Frank, for our listeners, Frank gave a talk right before we recorded this, and so I'll reference something from that talk. You noted that highway patrolmen have very different profiles in municipal police, that they're less likely to be racially discriminatory, they're less likely to have fruitless searches, they're mostly stopping people for traffic violations and safety reasons. I'm wondering if there's a general principle we can draw from this. Would it be a good thing if we got the municipal police out of the traffic game? Should there be traffic police and other police? Is that one way to organize our policing system and make it more effective?
Well, that's a good question. The fact that I was mentioning that you're referring to, just for the listeners, let me describe. It turns out that about half of all the traffic stops in North Carolina, as in most states, come from the State Highway Patrol. And, of course, the State Highway Patrol typically works on the interstate highways and the major throughways and big highways, and especially the interstates. And then rural areas tend to be policed by county sheriff's departments, and the urban areas have municipal police departments. And it turns out that across those three different types of police agencies, the search rates are highly different. And the, as you mentioned, the Highway Patrol search rate is very, very low, like 1/5 the statewide average. And then certain municipal police departments have much higher search rates, 10 times higher than the Highway Patrol, for example, and those tend to be the more urban police departments. So it seems clear that those police departments are using the traffic stops as a means to investigate people, whereas the Highway Patrol is giving tickets to speeders and then moving on to give a ticket to another speeder. But they're not using that speeding ticket as an opportunity to search the vehicle at the same rates as other types of agencies. So I think the real question is, are we getting a lot of crime-fighting value in these urban police departments by using the traffic code as a way to investigate people? Our evidence suggests that it's really not worth the effort. There's got to be better ways to investigate, get intelligence, find out who is involved in criminal activity. But the fact is, it's tempting for a police department because you have the legal justification to pull somebody over if they break any law, even if they make a wide right turn or they touch they change lanes without signaling. They've just opened themselves up to a police investigation at the discretion of the officer. And so it's part of the police culture to take advantage of these vehicle code violations and traffic law violations that might not be serious, but which are technically legal violations. And once you break a law, you can be investigated. So I think that's the real question. Are we getting a lot of benefit for this? The typical middle-class white American is unaware of these behaviors, unaffected by them. But the typical member of a minority community living on certain areas, because these policies are very focused, targeted on what the police call high crime areas, the typical person who lives there might have a really different range of experiences and much more experience with intrusive police behavior.
All right, well, we need to wrap this up. We're a little bit over our time. Frank, our last question we'd like to ask our guests, if people are interested in this topic, what other work of political science should they read that's not written by you?
Oh, well, there's a